everybody. Welcome to the Canine Connection Podcast. I'm here today with Denise Fenzi. Unfortunately, Lori couldn't join us. She had an emergency. But I am super excited that Denise is giving us her time. I have lots and lots of questions I want to ask her. And the first thing I want to know is her journey to start the Fenzi Dog Sports Academy, because I think if you look at somebody just on the surface, she has this successful school, she has a ranch, she's a well-known personality on Facebook, and these things don't just happen overnight out of nowhere. So Denise, tell me, because I want to know about your journey to start the school and everything you're doing now.
So I actually started many businesses before I got to FDSA with varying levels of success. Some of them were pretty, let's say, tragic, partly because I'm a super optimistic person and I trust people, very Pollyanna in many ways. And so that means I do a lot of things. I love doing things with other people. I get involved. And sometimes that works out and sometimes it doesn't. Some were, yeah, tragic. But FDSA, I started the school after somebody else asked me to teach a class at their online platform. And it was, in my opinion, shockingly successful. So that was, what, 13 years ago, 14 years ago. I, one, didn't know how well it would actually work. Like, how well can you teach a class? So that was the thing. Who's even going to find me, you know? And I would have continued working for that organization, except it was agility focused. And people couldn't find me there. So unless they changed the name, which I actually suggested to her, I go, look, if you change the name, I'll do all the obedience stuff. I'll even like run an obedience school for you with other people and such. But she was an agility person, so she didn't do that. And I just felt that there was going to be a lot of power in online learning after I experienced it. I was so impressed by how well people did that I decided to give it a shot. And it was new back then, so that was a thing. And I wanted to come in and cover a lot of territory at once. So I think I started out with 5 or 6 instructors, opened it up, and just wanted it to be very broad. And I will say it's gone way beyond my wildest dreams, like in terms of impact and attraction to people and success. So it's been a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Just how big it is. I look around, there really aren't that many online schools and certainly not that cover so many different topics, right? You cover pretty much like all sports just about.
Yeah. My experience is that there are a lot of individual contributors out there who offer their own whatever, you know, their own classes, okay, their own thing, which is super, especially since COVID, as we know, there was a lot of pivoting. And if you didn't pivot, you died as a dog trainer because you really couldn't make it. So you had to figure something out. And a lot of people did figure out the online space at that time. But no, there's not a lot of generic schools kind of that do what we do. My husband's perspective is that the school is successful because for a very, very long time, I've sort of had a single-minded focus on making the dog training sport community a little kinder towards dogs. And that's really been a driving thing in everything I've done. It's been a driving thing in my teaching. It's been a, you know, driver in my competing, in my private lessons when I was doing that, in my seminars, and then eventually in my online school. It's really not wavered that much. My goal is to help people find ways to get the results they want, especially in dog sports, being as kind as they can possibly be to their dog. So he thinks that that sort of single-minded focus is a big part of success. I really don't know. I'm just happy that, you know, things are where they are, they're at. I'm super proud of the school.
You should be. I think it is a big reason the school is super successful, because I think that it's where it's people have a place to go that want to work with their dog in that way. And those places aren't always around. And now, so, and it, there's a place to go regardless of what your sport you're in. And in certain sports, that's really hard to find.
Yeah, well, when I started the school 13 years ago, obedience is sort of my kind of first love and first competition sport. I mean, I've been doing it for 45 years. And back then, the only options you had were tracking, AKC tracking, AKC obedience, confirmation. I was before agility. So you really didn't have a lot of options. Mm-hmm. And so obedience is the direction I went. But I genuinely love obedience. But I can say that back when I was competing, it's very, very likely that I was the only person at any given dog show that was training with, when I say positive reinforcement, I mean without additional corrections. I'm not saying there's no such thing as force free, so I don't even talk about that. But what I'm saying is it was really important to me that I not be pulling on my dog or pushing or using a you have to do it sort of approach. And there were plenty of other people doing things there that I didn't have a problem with. I didn't think they were being unkind, but they were not doing what I was doing. And if somebody wanted to do what I was doing, their options were almost zero if they could not figure it out for themselves. Mm-hmm. It just didn't exist. Now, things are way better now. I know they are. When I go to fun matches, which is rare, but if I do, I see people doing like toy play. Nobody was playing with toys when I started. They were using food. And that came, I'm in the area where Judy Howard was, and she really brought food to obedience on the West Coast. We all thought she was cheating. It was like, oh, she's using food. Of course her dogs are doing it. But, you know, the rest of us wanted to win too. So, and she seemed to be winning, and she wasn't doing it in the ring. So she was above board, right? So that really is when I started to see food take hold. And I saw toys starting to take hold after I showed up. I'm not saying I brought toys. I'm just saying that until I was around and until agility people started coming back to obedience. So they started in obedience. They went over to agility and some of them came back and they brought some of those toy skills with them. When I was teaching heavily seminars like 17, 18 years ago, the number one thing people didn't understand and wanted me to teach them was how do you use toys in obedience? And I thought that was the oddest thing. I'm like, well, you know, where you'd use food, use a toy. And that 8 hours later, I'd be in a seminar and I'd realize it's actually not quite that simple. But that was a big change. And so now it's not unusual to see these things around training, you know, more food, more enthusiasm, more personal play, more toy play. And there's still plenty of, you know, degrees of corrections, but at least on the West Coast, I think there is at least a desire to have a dog that's buying in. And that wasn't necessarily true, especially when I started with my dogs so many years ago. It didn't even cross my mind that I didn't care how the dog felt. I mean, I really didn't. I remember pulling dogs out from under the table to train them. So that's not exactly buying in, but it didn't matter to me. That's not why I was there. I was a kid. And my whole mind was so different. And now I'm like, I won't even do it. Like, there's no way I'm going to train a dog who doesn't want to do it. It just would mean nothing to me. I would have no value in there if it wasn't my partner and my friend.
What caused it? What created that change? What triggered that?
Well, the first dog I trained him with positive methods, and then I proofed him with corrections. And that was, I was 25, I'm 56 now. So I don't know what the math comes out, but anyway, and he was also my first Belgian. And the shift was not intentional. It was just that I wanted to start working with him. And the tradition then is you didn't train until they were 6 months of age. And so what was I going to do with him between 2 months and 6 months? Right. So I thought, okay, well, I'll start training him when he's 6 months, but in the meantime, I'll just do these obedience tricks, right? Like healing and stay and fronts and finishes and recalls and retrieving and oh, sendaways. And he was just a very bright dog. And I had, as I recall, he was, hold on a sec. Hey, I know you're playing, but no. I think he was 26 months. He was a champion UDT. So he learned very fast. He had a high end trial. He was pretty easy to work with. So by 6 months of age, that dog knew a lot of stuff and I was doing it with the ball. So then at 6 months, I was going to get out the choke chain and start training him. But that seemed a little silly because he was doing well. So I didn't. So 7 months, 8 months, 9. By the time he was 10 months old, I felt like he knew everything through utility in my backyard, right? So kind of the classic high and trial in your backyard dog, you know? And then I took him to a training class, and I could not wait to show off my amazing dog. But my amazing dog wasn't there that day. My amazing dog was so overwhelmed by the environment and so excited. And then my brain kicked in and said, okay, because I didn't understand what I was looking at. So then it was like, well, it's time for the corrections because he knows this. So now I have to make him do it. So that's when, with that dog, I started using some corrections, but really it was all pretty light-handed because he knew it. And it was just, okay, you have to do it when we're in public or whatever his issue was, like when there's other dogs around or whatever.
Right.
And that kind of went like you'd expect. It kind of worked and it kind of didn't. it's like, they're not dumb. Like, oh, okay. So when you're correct, if you're correcting me, then I probably shouldn't do those things. But when you're not correcting me, I'll still do those things. Okay. So life went on. And then I used to work for the federal government. I actually have my master's degree in public administration. And, I had planned to do that as my work, my job. And then dogs are my entertainment, my hobby for fun. And that was fine until I had a child. And I had a really difficult child, and I just could not figure out how I was going to put him in daycare and go to work. It was just not going to work. He was like, he needed constant attention. He was a really challenging boy. And so I ended up not going back to work. But then that left me home with a toddler, and I'm like the worst stay-at-home mom. I mean, it's not that I'm a bad mom. I just, my attention span's very short, and I'm not a child person. Now, don't get me wrong. I love my kids and all, but like when I see a mama and a baby, I have no particular need to go see them. I just don't.
Now, I'm the same.
I spend a lot more time looking at puppies and dogs than I do looking at human children. And so I loved my own children, but you know, this was also the internet was just starting. So everything was, there was no like cell phone. So your life was, you know, I was in the house alone. My husband was working in Texas and we lived in California. So he was flying back and forth. It was grim. And I was really struggling with that and desperately wanted to get back to my dog stuff. And I had bought a dog when I had a human child, which I don't really recommend, but whatever. So I had this lovely, lovely drivey dog. So much fun. And I just worked it out where I would go to the IGP club and I got some private lessons there. And somebody else said, well, you know, will you help me with my, it wasn't me personally, it was his dogs. And I think I got $50 a day to board and train his dogs, but I didn't care because it was enough that it paid for a babysitter so that I could go and train dogs, my own dogs a few days a week and just frankly be around adults. And somehow I never went back to work and my husband stayed at work. And so I called myself a stay-at-home mom for years and years and years, even though I was doing more and more lessons, starting to do more stuff myself than people were inviting me to teach seminars. And next thing you know, I guess I was a dog trainer and, you know, it just sort of happened. It transitioned. And what happened is I had this dog, Soja. She was just such a little powerhouse, such a fun dog. There was just no place for the corrections. It just didn't make sense. She had the focus that the other dog didn't have. And so where was I going to start with these corrections? So I got an IGP-3 on her without corrections. And there was, you know, at some point it started to become, can I do this? Like the contest of it became really interesting. And there was also the way I was seeing training at that club was so hard to watch, so compulsive. My God, I mean, it was just terrible, the things they were doing. And as I watched that, I was thinking, they need to know that you don't have to abuse your dog. Like I wasn't having a problem with corrections per se, but they were strangling dogs. Like it was, it was unlike anything I'd ever seen in an AKC environment. It was just terrible.
It's like field work. They're
it was
brutal.
Awful. And that was before e-collars. So it wasn't even e-collars, but the brutality was really hard for me. And I didn't want that. So I think I was working away from that as much as I was working for positive. And then my dog kind of looked happy and their dogs didn't look too happy. And so they started to notice, and I like being different. I'm a little bit contrary just by nature. And then I got, you know, that, so I did get an IGP3 on that UDT dog, Justin. And then I bought a working line dog that was Soja. But with her, there was just no place to use corrections. She's just such a hardworking dog, such a cool dog. And I took her in the AKC ring with no preparation, you know, 2/199, just high into her right off the bat. Just such a good, successful little dog. And ended up giving her to her co-owner to do agility with because I just felt she'd be happier there. And so she took her. And I had one of her puppies. That was Reka, who I should tell this story at some point. But anyway, you saw her at the NOI in Long Beach. And all this time, I was doing everything myself more and more positively because it was interesting and I wasn't finding places to correct. It just wasn't coming up. But I was still using corrections with my students. And because it was easier. It's just, it was easier to tell somebody to correct when the dog does it wrong. And it wasn't like I was hard-handed. I was actually quite soft. But there were still corrections in there. And it didn't, that part didn't really change until I did a lot of seminars. And one day I was just like, I never even get to the dogs. Like, there's so many issues with the people and the way they're handling and their food placement and their choice of reinforcement and the choice of environments and where they're standing, and they're causing all their problems. And so I was just like, I mean, a really simple, Zen, could you play somewhere else? A simple example, you do a recall and your back is against the wall. And so the dog doesn't come all the way in because of the pressure of the wall. And so then they correct their dog in. So now their dog stands further back. Like, that is such an, that's, to me, that's such an obvious and easy fix. Like, don't do your recall against the wall. And now the dog comes in. Very nice. Now slowly back up to the wall, right? So, and that was all I did. I felt like just dog after dog was, your dog heels wide because you walk into your dog. Your dog heels close because you walk the other direction. It, your dog lags because your shoulder is back. Your dog forages because you're wrapping your arm. It just went on and on. And I just remember kind of being in one seminar and just thinking, I never get around to correcting the dogs in seminars. I'm just fixing these things that people don't see. They don't think about. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of when I went home and thought, what happens if I train my clients the way I train my own dogs? Like, and it's really hard. I mean, all I can say is it's really hard because I'm not training their dogs. I'm training them to train their dogs, and they are all over the map, right? In terms of their skill level.
Yes.
But my creativity went through the roof because all of a sudden I had to solve problems that I knew how to solve very easily with a correction. I had to figure out how to communicate to the person, first of all, where it came from, because now it mattered where it came from, because now we're going to have to get out of that. And then I had to think up answers to problems like dogs doing a send away, spinning on the way out. Like, oh, wow, what do I do about that? Like, I just remember it always. And your brain just kind of goes on steroids. You know, it's like amazing when you have to solve a problem, especially when you're in front of people. I don't know, the problems, the solutions come to me, or at least it may not be the solution, but a possibility. So we try it, and then maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. But you're on a path. And, you know, the nice thing about being a competition dog trainer, you have this with students for years. So that means you have the opportunity to see. Like in a seminar, there's no responsibility. You come in, you do your thing, you leave. You can make a mess or you can make things better, but you're not around to see where it all goes. But when you have clients and you see them over and over again, you really have an opportunity to try out a lot of paths. And I think you learn a lot about not only what works and what doesn't work, but what are the ramifications. So if you apply this solution, what happens to the whole big picture? And then after a while, I'm doing fine. I didn't find that I needed the corrections. And after a while, the kind of clients I tended to get, I am in an area with a lot of high power trainers. And so I got either very low drive dogs because nobody knows what to do to motivate them, or very high drive dogs because nobody knows what to do to calm them down. So I kind of got the extremes, and I got a lot of people that the other trainers didn't want. So the other trainers got really good dogs and wanted that, and they themselves were very successful and their clients were very successful. And I was learning on dogs that, you know, the owners were often really lovely people, but they were not talented And I remember the first time I got a dog, it was a golden bred for work with an Otch handler. And I was literally just blown away. I'm like, my God, this is so easy. It's cheating. Like it was just, it was so easy. Everything you did worked. And that was the experience I had with my own dog, like Soja. It was like, wow, this is so easy. Like she wants to do it. She's easy to motivate. She's in the game. And that's how I feel about the border collie I have now. It's like, he's complicated in his way. But some things are just so easy. I'm like, damn, you show him five times and he's got it. And I don't have to worry about rate of reinforcement. And this is fun. But that's kind of how I crossed over. It wasn't like one day I was, one day I wasn't. And even with my own dogs, I can't even really say for sure. Like with hindsight, I really could not say for sure, did I use corrections on this dog or that dog? I don't really remember because it wasn't like it is now. You know, now there's a wall. So you're either goodness and light and positive reinforcement, or you're the evil devil and you're a balance trainer, right? So we didn't do that so much back then. There wasn't that hard divide. So it didn't matter that much if a person was mostly positive reinforcement corrected a dog. It wasn't like the heavens were going to fall in like it is now.
I think a huge point was when you started to realize that, that you weren't at the seminars, that you weren't really working with the dogs, that it was all the handlers, right? I think if you realize that most of these, like why you don't need to correct a dog that's not coming close enough because of the wall, because if you just change your handling, the problem's resolved, right?
Yeah. So
then you don't need the correction. If you fix your handling, if you do better training, then you end up not needing to do corrections because you're giving the dogs good information. You're setting the dogs up to succeed. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, look, they're doing it.
Problem went away. And there are absolutely issues that are not that simple. Because what I've learned since then, and what I'm really like fascinated by now, dogs have a personality. They have a temperament and they have opinions. So I struggle with Zen coming in close enough in front. And it's not because of pressure. It's because of conflict. When he's holding an object, he owns things. He has so much possession and he doesn't mind sitting there with me, but he knows I want to take it. And it's a constant, like 9 times out of 10, when he comes in, I don't take things from him and then he can do it. But every time I take something, it's like money out of the bank. And I can give it right back, but he knows I'm going to take it. And the poor little dog, it took me months even to get him to give me a toy. And he wanted me to throw it, but he couldn't give it to me. He could put it on the ground. We found some middle ground. So he would put it on the ground and then he would back away and then he could deal with it. But that's kind of an area that really interests me now, is understanding that, you know, inside of them, they have things that are wired in there too. And how do you work with those things? How do you avoid the conflict, which then causes the things you don't want to see, instead of fighting about it? Because it's frustrating when the dog comes into front and you reach and the dog turns their head away. And you're like, you know what? It's just your ball and I'm just going to throw it again. And you know that. But then that's the information right there. I know he wants me to throw it again. And yet the inability to just let me have it is so powerful. It's a conflict in him. Because it's like, I want you to throw, but I can't give you this. And that's, if you see it that way, then it's like, well, what do I need to do to, one, make him trust me that I'm not going to do it very often? And two, find ways to reduce that feeling that he's having, that pressure that he's having. And that is sort of endlessly fascinating, because there are so many things that dogs bring to the table that make it challenging for them to do the things we want them to do. It could be as simple as attention span, you know, like my little terrier. He's just got a very short attention span. And it's not that he's not trying. It's just that his brain gets pulled 100 different directions. And I'm just one little itty bitty corner. And becoming more sensitive to that and recognizing how hard it is for him has kind of helped me really get to acceptance, whether I end up competing with the dog or not. Because now I can accept it. It's not that big a deal to me anymore. If a given dog isn't going to make it, as long as I can make that dog happy, I'm kind of okay with it. I'd be sad if I didn't have any dogs, because I love to train. I want dogs to want to train. But a lot of that driver to do a certain thing, a certain way, has really gone down. And I think it's made my life a little bit easier. But I so love having two dogs that love, love, love to work. There's nothing they would rather do than something with me, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is really nice. I mean, I think they are all different. I mean, when I look at Zaina, when I take them swimming and I throw them bumpers, it's like her personality, it's like that's who she is in work. It's like she breaks and breaks and breaks. It's so hard. Her impulse control is terrible. It's so hard for her to sit. And then, like, she's swimming for her bumper, but she's looking at the other dog and the other dog, and she's, like, all over the map, right? And, like, and she's swimming back, and she's like, what's he doing? I'm like, can you just come back? Just come back. And I'm like, this is who she is when I train her. And this is why, like, she tries her little heart out, and that's all I can ask of her, right? And I can accept that. She cannot compete she's not as consistent as my other dogs, but she's still doing her very best. And that's okay. Like I have to recognize, like, this is the essence of who she is. The essence of who she is. I almost said as a person, but that's how I look at it. You know, the thing she does in life, that's exactly what she does in work. And I'm not going to change that. I mean, and I'm not going to try. I just do the best I can with what she presents. Like, she wants to work. She just, you know, has her own little flair.
You know, Crystal, because I know you were on her podcast recently, Crystal Wing. We were just talking about a dog. She's talking about a lab. And we were talking about a dog who's prone to very frantic behavior. And the dog simply can't sit still. It's got 2 seconds in it. And so she started making the cues all running, run around a cone, get on a platform, eat a cookie, run around a cone. So it was sandwiching every expectation, one position change, run around the cone. And she said it was so effective with this dog because movement, mindless movement, running, it's not like you can go around a cone the wrong way. Like, you either went around the cone or you didn't, right? So it's not... And she said it was amazing how fast the dog's ability to sit still increased on the platform as a result of this kind of super high speed, high intensity training. And I was listening to her and I said, you know, I love training dogs like that because you think really hard, like your brain is on fire because you just need to be on top of it. But it's also very hard for most people because you have to be 8 steps ahead of the dog and it forces you. But I loved, as we were talking about it, I loved how she worked with what the dog was, because trying to get the dog not to move, you can physically stop the dog from moving, but you can't stop the brain. And if you can't stop the brain, it's not actually going to work. Like, you have to figure out how to get the brain to engage. And I do not know of a way that you can force the brain to do your bidding, right? You just can't. Mm-hmm. And it was just fun to brainstorm that kind of a dog who was actually, it sounds like what you have. So could be a fantastic worker, so much talent, but man, that attention span, you better keep things going. You better have a plan because that dog was like all over.
Yeah. And she likes all her ducks in a row with training, which is pretty, pretty interesting. Like, she's so complicated because she's so many opposite things. She's just so complex. But, and if all the ducks aren't in a row, or if I take one half step out of line, she starts yelling at me, rah, 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 rah. Like, that is not how it goes. She's done it to me in the ring. It's hilarious. She's like, this is not how this goes. It's all wrong. You're not doing it right.
You're part of the bargain. You're a team.
That's right.
And she had to tell you how to do it.
For sure. And that's what she does.
Some dogs want to know what is expected of them. They need that clarity.
Yes. So like somebody asked me today, like, what's your percentage of how many straight recalls do you do with a dog versus a drop-on recall? I said, well, that's completely dog dependent, because with Zaina, I never do a straight recall. That makes her crazy because she goes, make up your mind. It's either a straight recall or it's a drop-on recall. And that dog she's 9 years old. She has never once anticipated a drop. And all I do is drop her. Now take another dog. If I dropped another dog all the time, well, they would be anticipating constantly. So, you know, every dog is so, but that's what I love about dog training, not just my dogs, but students' dogs. Like when they are challenging and you just have to figure out like, what in the world is this, you know, what is this dog thinking? What's this dog's personality? Like, what makes this dog tick? How does this dog process everything? I think that's the super fascinating thing about dog training.
Yeah, it's many lifetimes. And just when I think I worked it out, I mean, just when I think I have figured out how to solve this problem, and then the next dog comes up with the problem, I'm like, oh, this is perfect. And you know what? No. It's a different dog. It's a different presentation, and it's not going to work this time. It's amazing. It is a very humbling thing, training dogs, because, I mean, I went through a phase where I did know everything. The problem is it didn't hold up. So now I don't know everything anymore, which is so sad. It was really comforting to know that I could solve all the problems. I knew everything. I knew all of your problems. And then I actually had to solve problems. I'm like, oh, in theory, it looked really good. Like, that makes me laugh because, you know, you're on social media and somebody, you know, you say whatever your dog, and they go, well, you just, and they like, this is what I did, and you just whatever. And I'm like, God, that's so amazing. That worked for your two dogs. What about the other, like, 300 million dogs in this country? Like, are you sure?
But my dogs have been so different. I mean, I had, and so challenging, like such polar extremes. I mean, I remember Zayden, he was completely not wired right. I didn't even know for the first 2 years of his life. I just was like, God, this is like the hardest dog in the world to train. And then Zeal was terrified of, oh my God, they've all been so challenging. But I don't know. So I never got to the point where I think before I got Zayden, I thought I actually, for a minute there, I thought I knew what I was doing. I was very confident for like a minute.
Yep.
And then I started training him and I was like, I know what I'm doing. This puppy's going to be amazing. And he's like, I had him for like 3 months and I'm in my backyard and I sit on my rock wall and I go, this dog doesn't know a single thing I have been trying to teach him for 3 months. Like, this is going horribly wrong. And yeah, and from that day forward, I never again did I think I knew what I was doing. Now I'm just like, every dog is going to be a challenge. And it's just a constant learning process. But that's why I love it, because I feel like I know if it was easy, I'd be out. I would have been out decades ago.
Because you're done. Like, you did it.
I would have been bored. I'd just been totally bored.
Yeah. No, the challenge is awesome.
It's so hard and it's just endlessly fascinating, like endlessly fascinating to me. What I find interesting though is people, I mean, look, we all get frustrated. That's normal. I get frustrated with myself when I can't figure something out because I know my dog's trying. I'm like, I just can't figure this out. And sometimes I'll get frustrated, but like sometimes people get really upset and I'm like, yeah, but that's, what part of training, like whoever told you this was easy, that this was supposed to be just, you know, I think people get very frustrated when things very quickly. And I think they get frustrated with the dogs.
I think people have a fear that it will never get better. So, you know, the first time you watch a dog walk through the broad jump and my brain immediately says, holy shit, I never want to see that again. He's going to do it in the ring and we're never going to get a CDX or whatever. Like it's very easy to go there. Now, as a coach, I watch people go through that and I'm like, what are you talking about? But when I'm the person who's watching my dog walk through the broad jump, I've been there. I mean, I have so been there. And I think when I get upset in training, it's because I don't know if I can solve a specific problem. But I don't know. I've been around long enough. I just don't get that upset anymore. And also, if I do get upset, I stop training because I just know not to train upset. It never ends up a good thing. So stop the training. And I think you probably have this too. I have a a little bit of an obsessive thing. So my dog's position changes are not perfect. Now, perfect, I have a definition in my head, which has nothing to do with scoring, because they don't score on what I'm looking for. I don't want any foot to move. I want your feet to be, your front feet to plant and your rear moves and nothing else moves. So that would be my mental model. It's not about getting a perfect score. And I have been working on this for 4 years with this dog and I still don't have it. I think I'm closer. But the obsession is about, can I get it? And so it's not like I can't get position changes, and I can very likely get full point position changes right now if he's not in an arousal spike. But I care about it because I want to know how to do it. And that's the thing that's kind of got me. And it's like, why do I care? Why don't I just walk away? It's good enough. But then I'm like, that works for one day. And then I'm like, I wonder if I tried.
I'm the same way. I like love figuring things out. Like I remember with Zeal, that poor dog, like life, the planet was just really hard for him. And he got to a certain point in his training where when he was on, he was like 199 and above. I mean, he was a machine. But he would just randomly implode, and it would always be on one exercise, and it was never the same exercise in one weekend. And in a tournament, that would knock you out. So I was talking to a behaviorist that I had worked with, and I said, you know, I think this is just the best he can be, and I'm okay with that. And she's like, I think this is like beyond, yeah, he's already working so far beyond his ability, that his natural ability, that's you're never going to get any better than that. And I was like, okay, like I completely accept that. Like I can accept that he's doing the very best he can. But I never stopped trying to figure out, could I make it even better for myself? Like not because it even mattered. Like I had accepted that he was who he was, and that was more than good enough. But I just still wanted to figure out, like, can I make him more comfortable? Can I make him more, like, what could I do? And I'm glad I'm like that, because the fact that I continued doing that, that's when I eventually, like, I don't know, like came up with strategies that really helped him that I use with a ton of students now.
Right.
So I think that obsessive, you know, desire, like, can I figure this out? Like, can I solve this problem? That's our own personal journey, but it also ends up, I think, helping us tremendously as instructors.
Absolutely. Because that's, they benefit. I think what starts to happen, let's say you have 10 solutions to a specific issue, but you start to learn that these three solutions generally work on the higher energy dog. This one over here works on the lower. Like you start making patterns in your head, and it makes you much better at predicting. Because you can say to yourself, I've seen this type of a dog before, and this is what worked with that type. Because rarely do I find that there are solutions to problems. I find that there are different solutions to problems depending on where's the source of the problem. You know, is it the dog is afraid or who knows what? But I think when you've seen enough dogs, whether you've seen them in seminars or online or whatever, man, I mean, eventually, and you're probably in the same boat, you in some way worked with thousands. You work with thousands of dogs eventually, and you start noticing the patterns. And you go, all right, well, this pattern, this is what's worked for me in the past. What's harder, I find, is to solve my own problems. I find it much easier to solve other people's. With my own, I really have to stop and tell myself to look at it as an instructor. So watch the video, don't watch yourself training your dog. Watch it as if you were watching a client. And my God, that is so impactful. It works a high percentage of the time. I'll think of something I hadn't thought of or that should have been obvious to me that I should know. But it's harder to see it in your own sometimes than I think than in other people's.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, exactly. That's so funny that you said that. More recently, I'm like, oh my God, just step back and pretend this was your student. Like, what would you tell them? Because a few months ago, I was, I can't remember what I was struggling with. And so Lori, who had learned a lot from me, was like, well, why don't you try that? And I'm like, oh my God, I tell students to do that all the time. Why didn't I think to do that for myself? I was like, what's wrong with me?
There's really something to being too close to a problem. It's like it just, your analytical brain has more trouble and your emotional brain kind of clouds things. But I'm definitely much more successful if I am looking at it as an outsider and leaving my personal baggage behind. Because it's almost immediate. It's almost like, oh my God, your rate of reinforcement too low. You've been doing this too long. Like I can just instantly like boom, 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 boom. Like why can't I do that like in real time?
I think a big part of it for sure with my students, like I am able, like I remind myself all the time that like, just be a detective, like don't be emotional, just be a detective, right? Like gather data and then look at the data and solve the problem. Because it's exactly what you said. The dog makes a mistake. Oh God, they're going to do this in the ring, or I'm never going to, you know, this is going to be terrible. And students, for sure, I mean, they go down a rabbit hole and then I feel like I have to talk them off the ledge. And I'm like, it's really not that bad. You know, we'll figure it out. But I will say, I also think that's why the online school is so successful. When you first asked me, I don't remember if it was a webinar or a class. And in my head, I'm like, how in the world am I going to actually teach people? Like, I don't even understand how this is going to work, like on a computer online. And after a while, I was like, oh, this is fascinating. I'm like, these online students are learning more quickly than my in-person students.
Yes.
And I'm convinced it's because they have to record their sessions, then they have to look at them when they edit them. And I think that is like the most powerful information for them.
About a year after I started the school, it was a bit of an epiphany. I just realized how far ahead my online students were compared to my in-person students. And boy, did I stop and think about that. I mean, there's a lot of dynamic in there, but I thought about that. And one of the things, when you record your work, well, there's a lot of benefits, but one is it makes people feel nervous. Now, sadly, I'm past that. But for a long time, I got nervous when I turned on a video camera because I was being watched by my video camera. But that really helped with that transition to the ring, because this is how you feel nervous. And now I'm taking a gold spot again this term, and I took one last term. But what would happen is when I was doing the video, I'm seeing it from the point of view of the instructor instead of being there with my dog. And then I'm seeing all the problems. Like I'm like, I know what she's going to say because I'm a dog trainer. But when I'm by myself and the video camera's not watching me and I'm not going to turn that over to an instructor to get feedback, I don't see things in the same way. The other thing is we all have different styles. When I was teaching classes, my feedback was time-stamped. So I would say at 7 seconds, I want you to look at your hand position. Mm-hmm. Then I want you to look at what you did at 18 seconds, and I want you to notice how your dog responded. So I was very into the time-stamping. When I'm working with somebody in person, what you did at 7 seconds is you don't remember. You don't know what your hand was doing. It's gone. It's off your chart. Mm-hmm. So I can talk about what you're doing right. I can talk about what you're doing wrong, but you can't watch it with me. And I think students would go back and they'd be like, oh, that's so obvious. That's so obvious. Mm-hmm. Or walk in a straight line. Now look at those lines on the ground and look where you started and look where you ended up. And they're just like, God, you're right. If you tell somebody that in real time, they don't mean to, but their first reaction is to be defensive. It didn't happen. I didn't do that. Right. And they don't say that, but you can kind of feel that little bit of unsureness with some people, a little bit of defensiveness. In a video, the video doesn't lie and you're not in the situation and you're not trying to figure out what to do with your dog while you're talking to me and you're not hot and cranky and whatever. You're sitting in your house watching a video together and going, I see it, I see it. And suddenly I can almost feel the student being like, I can't wait to get outside and do this better, which is really different than when you're sitting there with the dog who at this point might be totally tired and done. Right. So I felt that my students were... Oh, and the other thing is I can explain the why. Online, it's not that I don't do it in person, but you don't remember it. It's just you can only hold so much. when I write out lectures, I know that they're in their reading brain. So they're reading for a while and they're trying to understand. And now they're in their working brain. But if they forget, they go back to the reading brain. And I took a couple of herding lessons online with my puppy. And I also took an in-person lesson. And I loved the in-person because I loved the connection with a person. But I don't remember anything. And I videotaped. And it wasn't good enough to go back and watch it. When I did a lesson where I submitted a video and then she reviewed it and she got out a whiteboard and she was showing me sheep and all this, oh my God, when I went to my next lesson, I sat down, I reviewed everything she said. I made sure I had an exact plan in my head before I walked out on that field. And it was one of my best sessions because I was so structured, but I was fresh and my dog was fresh. And I was still in the car reviewing what I was supposed to do, exactly what it was supposed to look like. I can't do that when I'm standing with an instructor in real time. At this point, my dog's exhausted. He's already done several runs. So many things are going on. And I'm also feeling like she's watching me. I'm trying to respond to her. I'm trying to watch my dog. I'm trying to watch my sheep. So going forward, I think I'm going to really do 95% of my lessons online, even when, I mean, I'll do seminars when I have a chance and such. But I just felt like, wow, this works for me. And I know people are individuals. And they need different things, but I was like so happy. And the other thing that happened is she said, I know you didn't ask me about this, but there's this other thing you need to know about. So she told me about something because I didn't edit my video. I just sent her like 6 minutes straight. And I said, comment on all of it, anything you want. Mm-hmm. So she saw something I didn't even know enough to know that I had a problem. Like I'm just too new. Right. And I think that can be really valuable. Like you can get feedback on, I call it the spaces in between. So you might not know that when you're setting up, you disconnect from your dog and you get your stuff. Uh-huh. But in a video, I can point out to you, hey, I want you to notice your dog's expression when you walked away there because you left your dog hanging and your dog didn't know what to do and you lost a lot of power there. When I do that in person, I find it's a lot harder. It's not that I can tell them, but they don't see their dog's expression. They don't see what happened for those 15 seconds when they had their back to their dog. In real time, I put a stop to that, right? But so they don't get the impact of the failure. So I would say it's been very surprising to me that I have found it to be more effective than, I mean, the ideal is both because in person, sometimes you just want to put your hands on someone and just move their body. I mean, I do that. That's why we have like camp. So I can do that. But big picture, I love what I get. And I've talked to people who teach seminars and go to things and they say, I can tell the FDSA students, I can identify them. I can tell from their handling. I can tell by the things they do, the way they interact with their dog. And I love that. And they, you know, it's a notable difference. It's really cool. They clearly are they're well-trained. They understand they're paying attention. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think, them seeing it, I've been doing my, homework reviews with video. Mm-hmm. So I can go see right here and have my little cursor. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, I find after even just a few weeks, they start seeing those things themselves. And I think that's huge. And then sometimes they're like, well, I can't see it yet in real time, but that's okay. Like that's a huge step, even just seeing it yourself. Now you're really close to seeing it in real time. And that's something people really struggle with is reading their dogs in general, but reading them in real time and reading, because if you're not, then more often than not, you don't even know why the dog did what it just did because you're not reading what's going on. You're just like, the dog did not do the behavior I asked it to. Well, but why?
Right. What happened 5 seconds earlier? And on video, you can go back and look at what happened 5 seconds earlier. Mm-hmm. Right. And in real time, it's easy to forget because you get wound up in the problem. So what I tell people, like kind of regardless, videotape your work. I just find it so powerful to go back and look at, even if you're doing all the review yourself. And I don't watch all my videos. It depends. But I usually, I'll set it times five, my video, whatever I did that day, and I'll watch it. Because at times I was like, yeah. Whoa, wait, what was that? Right. And then I turn it down and I watch it again. Cause sometimes I'd seen the most stunning things. Like I had no idea like my dog's creeping on his sniff stay. I had no idea how much he was moving. And then I had the video camera on him once and I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Because he does such tiny little steps that you can't even see it in real time.
Hey, everybody. So big surprise. I was not watching the time and Denise and I talked for a very long time. So we decided to split this into two episodes. So we're going to stop this episode here. And but stay tuned. We will have the second part out next week. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you so much to Denise for giving us all her time. And we'll see you guys next week.